You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. On today's episode of After Images podcast, we are delighted to welcome author Jen Fox for a discussion of Michael Powell and Imric Pressburger's 1948 film, The Red Shoes. Drawing on Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale of the same name, the narrative follows aspiring ballerina Victoria Page, played by real-life dancer Moira Shearer, in her first screen appearance. Shearer portrays a rising star at the Ballet Lermontov, where her character must choose between an ascending career and her love for Julian, a composer who works for the same ballet troupe. Peppered with additional performers of dance stardom, the film's 17-minute ballet sequence is recognized as a milestone in film history for the ways in which the choreography and cinematography are intertwined creatively. Accumulating numerous accolades since the time of its release up to the present, including Academy Award nominations and a place on the Best Films of All Time list, The Red Shoes is a marvel of psychological drama, horror, romance, and of course, music and dance, all wrapped in technicolor wonder.
Our guest, Jen Fox, is the author of Mannequin and Wife, a Shirley Jackson Award nominee and Forward Indies gold medalist, and Tells the Devil Told Me, a World Fantasy Award finalist, and Large Hearted Boy's Favorite Story Collection of 2021. Her fiction won the 2021 Porter Fun Literary Prize and has appeared in One Story, Lit Hub, The Iowa Review, Swamp Pink, and others. A two-time finalist for the Calvino Prize in Fabulous Fiction, Fox lives in Little Rock, Arkansas. Her debut novel, Daughters of Chaos, called Ferociously Radiantly Compelling by Kelly Link, and a dazzling synthesis of history, myth, and sheer invention by Charles Yu, has just been published by Abrams.
Welcome, Jen Fox, to After Images podcast. Thank you so much for being with us today. We're delighted that you chose to discuss Powell and Pressburger's 1948 film, The Red Shoes. When we start the podcast, we usually like to begin with the question, why did you choose this film? What does it mean to you?
Thank you so much, Marisa. And Frank, it's wonderful to be here. I'm thrilled to be here to discuss potentially my favorite movie, definitely my first favorite movie with you all. So The Red Shoes was my father's very favorite film. My father, his mother was a dancer, and she taught dance throughout his life. And his parents were both they were very culturally aware. They were very much big supporters of the arts. They encouraged him to express himself. My father, he was a composer. He was a pianist and a composer. He was also a visual artist. He painted and drew. He also was an amateur magician and puppeteer. I mean, so he was like very, you know, many of the elements of The Red Shoes, you know, all of the kind of look at an artistic group that are all working together to achieve, you know, greatness was sort of like his milieu growing up. Like he was in this environment growing up. So my father, when I was a child, I saw the film so often that when I was growing up that I thought it came on network television regularly, like The Wizard of Oz or, you know, White Christmas or, you know, like a seasonal, I thought it was a seasonal thing. But it turns out that it was my father showing it to me over and over every time I would go visit him in the summers when I was a child, because my parents split up at a point, my sister and I would go visit him. And so I also started dancing when I was five. I started taking ballet at five. And that was my first ambition, was to be a dancer. And ballet being sort of, you know, especially in the 20th century, the most pure, sort of the purest form of dance. That was, you know, what I aspired to. Now, I am a rather Amazonian woman. I'm 5'8". I'm really big. Like, there's no way that I was ever going to be like a ballerina. But I am a good dancer. And so anyway, the movie, not only, you know, not only did I want desperately to be Vicky Page, not only was I, you know, the character of the dancer who is picked out and, you know, and is, you know, and is sort of her own, in her own fairy tale, you know, within the movie. But the excitement of the world, the backstage world, you know, I love it. Also, like, my entire life now, many of my obsessions, both in my writing and just in my workaday life, when I watch this movie now, I'm like, oh, this came directly from the Red Shoes. Oh, this came directly from the Red Shoes. Like, so much of what I am drawn to and what I love and what comes up in my own writing, I can now trace. Like, every time I watch it, I'm like, wait a minute, did that also come from the Red Shoes? Like, my insane, like, obsession with frame narratives and with, you know, triangles that aren't necessarily love triangles, but that are weird emotional other kinds of triangles and stuff like that. So, so yeah. And my mother also loved the movie. Like, the way every time my mother said the Red Shoes, she said it like Lermontov says it in the very last scene when he's like, Victoria Page, you know, cannot appear tonight. And he says, we are going to perform the Red Shoes anyway. You know, when my mom always said it that way, because my mom was very funny and she was a crazy lady too. But anyway, so it's like I may have seen this movie more than any other on earth, you know? Yeah. So it's foundational for me in a lot of different ways, if that's enough.
So interesting to hear you describe this inspiration, because I feel like whether people went on to become professional dancers or not, you just have so many dozens of testimonies that talk about how inspiring the film was, and in particular, how growing up it inspired a lot of young women to turn to dance. And Suzanne Farrell, the famous ballerina with New York City Ballet, once said that she saw the film on television as a child growing up in the 40s and the 50s, and that there was a moment in the film, you know, after the red shoes have come off in the ballet sequence, where Leonid Massine, the shoemaker, holds out the shoes again as if to say, who wants them? And she always says, I'll take them, I'll take them. And I'm wondering, because of that desire to possess the red shoes, how do you reconcile that with the horrific aspects of the film and the more kind of gruesome quality of Vicky Page's death and what the red shoes traditionally represent in the Anderson fairy tale?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I guess I've always been, and I don't know, you know, I guess I've always been drawn to sort of the darker, and I don't know how much of this is, you know, it's a direct, both of my parents, like, again, you know, I was raised by my mom pretty much single-handedly. We stopped seeing my dad when I was about 11 or 12, but they both wanted to be writers. Like, they both wrote. My parents, after they got divorced, they decided they were going to be an ex-husband and ex-wife writing team. And they worked on books together, like genre books. Like, he was writing thrillers. And I discovered all this after my dad's, this is all way too much information, but I discovered all this after my dad's death when I went, as we had been estranged for many years, but I went to settle his estate and I found these manuscripts, like these boxes of manuscripts and these letters that he had written to publishers, like about he and my mom and like how they were this ex-husband and ex-wife writing team. So I'd say like I was, my mother was a voracious reader and she gave me wildly inappropriate books to read when I was way too young. So I always was, you know, I was not shielded from any of the sort of darker aspects of life. And I don't know how much of that is like, both in terms of like our financial situation, right? And like that kind of thing. And also, and then in terms of like, just generally being alive, I'm, you know, reading books. I'm like, Mom, what's, you know, what is angel dust? She's like, well, it's a drug. It's also known as PCP, you know, and I'm like 8 or 7. And she's, and so, you know, I guess I've always been drawn to, not so much horror, but like mystery. And I mean, some aspect, there are definitely aspects of the horrible. And then at the same time, one of my favorite books growing up was Italo Calvino's Italian Folk Tales. And I read folk tales and fairy tales. Like, they are a huge influence on my work. So the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, you know, and I actually reread it, you know, before this, because I was like, you know, it's been a long time since I've taken a look at some of this stuff. But you know, I when I was a child, I didn't think about right. And it is funny to think now about when I was, say, 8 years old and I watched this movie and I was like, Vicky Page, I want to be her. And then what ends up happening to her. You know, I'm sure that at the time I must have asked my parent, you know, I must have been like, you know, this is, but I don't know. I don't know why I was just, I've always been more interested in sort of the dark underside of things, I would say, in a way that maybe a lot of young girls aren't, you know. I was but the fact that it inspired so many young girls to dance, this movie, you know, and you know, this movie, it did show, you know, I think that one of the things about this movie is it shows more of like the work that goes into performance than probably any movie had before, and the kind of how much you really have to sacrifice to do this, you know, to give people this gift of art performance. You know, and now subsequently, like I also watched Black Swan because I hadn't watched that since it came out. But I was just like, let me watch that again, you know, because I remember enjoying it and I saw it when it came out in theater, but I hadn't revisited it. You know, it seems like, you know, today we're much more like getting into the nitty-gritty of how really like the real pain, like the physical pain and the actual, you know, but I think that the Red Shoes, you know, it gave this more realistic look at performance. And the fact that there were all these people who make up, I mean, I really love the, I love the way that you see so much of the core and of the, and of the group, the dancing troupe, and how you see the people who are actually doing it. Like there's one person who's the star, yes, but there are like legions of dozens of people who are handling everything else. So I think it gave it, but I've wandered way away from your question, which was about like the gore.
But there's so much to dig into.
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, I don't know, you know, I guess I never had, I was never like someone who had like a, like I'm gonna get married and have a life and be normal. That was never ever even a, like a remote possibility for me. So I don't know if how much of it was that both my parents were super weird and gave me like, you know, it gave me ideas that other kids probably weren't exposed to, like put that stuff into my head, and how much of it was like my personal, you know, me being just a weirdo. Because like for instance, my sister, who we grew up in the same situation, she was not interested in the arts or in dance. Well, she did visual art, but she wasn't interested in these things in the way that I was, you know.
But
So
it's interesting to put the film in perspective with the use of traditional fairy tales, which are, I mean, usually very dark and they can become very gruesome.
yeah.
But at the same time, they have some sort of a message for the children, which is to stay on the path, basically, and not to leave it to go in the forest where the wolves are. What is according to you the message of the Red Shoes, if it is a transposition of the traditional fairy tale to the 1950s?
Well, I guess, I mean, you know, and this is, you know, if you say people like, and I'm sure you guys must know this, but people like Scorsese and Coppola, I mean, you know, it there's a way in which you could see it as saying art for art's sake is the only art worth making, trying to make. Forget about it in any other context. You know, that's like pure art, pure cinema. You know, these ideas, this film, and you know, Powell and Pressburger, I because of this film, I am also like I know I Powell and Pressburger are really important for me. I know their whole catalog. Like I love their films. And it all comes back, but I didn't start watching the other films of theirs until I was probably in my late 20s, early 30s, when I just went crazy. Like at around that age, I became just like an insane cinephile. I just like, and I mean, I knew a lot of movies from my childhood growing up with my parents who showed me tons of, you know, but I became just like obsessed, kind of obsessed with Powell and Pressburger. So the idea, and you know, Michael Powell, I think, felt this, you know, he really felt this way. And I think a lot of, you know, Scorsese, you know, other directors who, the one of the reasons they were so inspired by this movie is because it is saying, you know, what it is nakedly saying is art is more important than life. And that's kind, you know, and that is, that's a hard pill for many people to swallow. Not so much for someone like me, though, to swallow. But I think you can also, I think there's another lesson in the film that you can, if you are someone who needs more of a, you know, slightly something slightly less dark, I think that Lermontov's character is potentially the most lonely man, the like one of the saddest, most lonely characters who has ever been committed to film. Like, I mean, especially watching it now at my age, you know, I see myself identifying with him more, which is strange. But I mean, he, you know, as represented in the film, I feel like he's a character who is, it, for some reason, incapable of love. He can't love others the way that other people can love each other. And he's decided to replace that with his obsessive love of art, creating perfection, something to show the world that is, you know, unlike anything anyone else has ever done. He has replaced love with his ambition. And I think in that way, you know, and even when the film ends, I believe that there's a shot of him alone in his box. I think, you know, I know that he's out on the stage, and then it might come right before that. But I think that these shots of him, that there are a lot of shots of him alone that really reinforce. And so I think there's a way in which you could take away that, you know, Vicky and Julian, they love, they lost, but they love, you know, they found it, the thing that is it for all humans. What we all need is someone to love us and to be able to love someone else and exchange that feeling. And that Lermontov he's incapable of it. And so he, for me, kind of, there's a way you could read it as, you know, being sort of, he's the loser in the end, even though he's a successful, going to continue to be a successful impresario and run this company and, you know, discover more dancers, you know, it's, or, you know, talented young people and whatnot. You know, there's a way in which I think Vicky and Julian are the actual winners of the movie. And, you know, I think they're painted that way, you know, in a lot of instances in the film. When they get together, I mean, the scene where they're in, is it Monte Carlo, when they're in the carriage, that where the driver is asleep, that whole sequence, and then she decides to go with him. They get this very long, joyous, you know, pretty fairly, you know, heartfelt. Whereas Lermontov, I mean, whenever he's alone, you know, it's he's angry. He's, you know, there's the punching the mirror scene. And so I think that's a way that you could sort of say, hey, this movie is not necessarily saying kill yourself for art.
And I think it's interesting because the moment when they are the most happy is when they are drifting together, because the person who is driving the cart is asleep. Whereas when they have a goal, when they are really focused on something, this happiness tends to disappear, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's the, I mean, you know what's in, I mean, I guess this is obvious, but the one of the things that struck me as I was watching the movie this time too is the fairy tale within the fairy tale within. So I'm like frame tales and stories within stories. It's just how I work. Like I work that way. It just seemed to come to me naturally when I started trying to write and figuring out how to present stories to readers. And I think so much of that comes from this kind of tale. You know, growing up when frames, because I mean, frames are so useful. I love work that acknowledges its own artifice and acknowledges that it's something that's made. And that's, I think that's one of the reasons The Red Shoes for me is so, it's mind blowing, because it does so many inversions, and it goes inside the story and then inside the story and then inside the story. It does that so many times. It's very complex. Like it's an incredibly, you know, complex film, but yeah, I think, Julian and even though, you know, even though I guess running time wise, their romance, it doesn't take up all that much like real estate, right? In terms of like the length of the film, it's so, you know, and what you said about the drifting carriage, I think that's exactly right. I think, you know, both of them are being directed, you know, by, you know, the entire time that this is, they're both ambitious, talented people. They're both being directed by this one person, and then the when they manage to get away from him and they're allowed to just drift and not that's when they're really able to find each other, be themselves, be who they truly are under the layers of artifice together. And then also the scene, you know, there's the scene where they're Julian gets up in the middle of the night and goes to play, and she looks at her shoes, and she clearly, you know, she is torn. I mean, this woman is, you know, I really think Maura Shearer's performance, like, and, you know, she was, I mean, you guys know, I mean, of course, she was untrained, you know, she was just, she was a dancer who really, really wasn't sure about doing the movie, you know, but I always, and to this day, I feel like her performance is very nuanced and very, really well done, that kind of, the being torn, you know, the way that she portrays, so being torn between life and art, is incredibly skillful. But yeah, it's definitely the time when there's no, when they're drifting, you know, and that whole, and, you know, Julian, she tries to wake up the driver and Julian doesn't let her, you know, and he's like, let's just continue to drift. But
and yeah. You mentioned these different stories within stories and the framing. And here I'm thinking about this revolutionary ballet sequence, a 17 minute long ballet within the film that references the original fairy tale, as well as what's happening with the characters in the film. So you've got all those layers kind of simultaneously unfolding. And I think that it really ushered in an era of movie musical dance sequences that really took to a more dreamlike, not necessarily escapist, but a more fantasy way of approaching what was happening inside the character's psyche. And I'm just wondering, as a child who watched a lot of films, what did you think of the ballet sequence? And then going forward, did you appreciate other ballet sequences and classic movie musicals?
Yeah. You know, as a child, it's hard for me to remember exactly, you know, but I do know as a child, because I was so interested in dance, that I absolutely loved, you know, I loved the ballet sequence. And, you know, watching it as an adult, I can see, and I know that that was at the time when it came out, I think it was kind of a big, you know, stumbling, you know, the producers were like, wait a minute, I don't know if this is, you know, and they really didn't like get behind it when it first came out. But then, of course, you know, I think someone started showing it in the States and it, you know, it like took off. But yeah, there's, I mean, the influence, you know, on, you know, singing in the, I mean, on movie musicals in general, Singing in the Rain and American, I mean, I think that they, that the people who made those for like Gene Kelly, I think that they've referenced, right, the Red Shoes as a, yeah. So I think that, you know, taking, first off, I'm going to say, because I would be mad if I didn't say this, even as a child, the costumes, the ballet, the modern, the women, how they had modern, like, period 1940s, like, their costumes were modern, and they had toe shoes that were all dyed to match their costumes. I was, and I still to this day, every time I watch it, I'm like, and then also in the funeral scene, all the women who are in the procession, they're on point in their black toe shoes, like walking in. I'm like, ah. So the look of the design of the ballet, it was so, and you know, that was when ballet was, you know, the 40s, 50s was when ballet was opening up and becoming, you know, allowing the modern, you know, sort of the more modern, you know, this is right at the time when all this was happening. And I mean, you know, Leonid Massin as the you know, and I've been looking up everybody. Like, I knew some about the dancers, but not as much. But like Robert Helpman being Margot Fonteyn's like main, you know, one of her main partners, dancers, you know, over the years. And I think Robert Helpman was the one who choreographed the ballet sequence in the Red Shoes. But yeah, I think that, you know, there was a, and it's sort of it presaged, there's a way in which I think that the fantastical, you know, that fantastical break in the middle of the movie that gives us like a space of not necessarily reality, sort of surreality or unreality, sort of presages movies that were coming in like the 60s and 70s, in which, you know, the sort of the movement of the, like, say, you know, experimental films of the 60s, you know, and like, what is, like, the only movie that's coming to my mind is Head, like the Monkees movie, but like films made in the 60s that were, or even films that combine animation and real action, like Mr. Limpet, like The Incredible Mr. Limpet, or like Herbie, you know, I mean, things, I mean, that's a little later, but I think that, especially from filmmakers, you know, I mean, like, I mean, Powell and Pressburger had done, you know, obviously Stairway to Heaven. Like, I mean, they had gotten into the realm of the strange. But that extended break, I think, gave other filmmakers and people, not just filmmakers, probably, I mean, writers, you know, gave other people creating art, like the idea that we could take the space to explore the strange and braid it into the real, which is like, that's pretty much my mode of writing is, you know, fabulism, or, I mean, some people say magical realism, but I think of that really as a Latin, you know, as a term that's more for Latin, you know, for Latin writers. But I think of what like Western, you know, sort of the Western or like American, European, you know, those of us who put the unreal or the uncanny or the magical into the everyday, mm-hmm. that's just my go-to mode of writing. And I wonder now how much of it, like really the genesis of it was this movie, you know, for me, looking at this movie, I'm like, this is like the genesis of everything I do in my work, you know, so much of what I do. But I think that freedom to work in unreal ways. I mean, people have been working in the unreal. I mean, people were, I'm sure, working in the unreal before they were really working in the real in terms of representation, right? Because why would you represent reality? Like really early on, you know, people, you know, potentially the first stories we made up were about the gods to explain what was happening. You know, at that time, there wouldn't have been any point in like representing reality. But I like plenty of realism. You know, I like anything that's like well done, but I've always been drawn to the uncanny, the magical, something that like slips and shifts into something that is not quite real. And I think that, you know, that dance sequence in this movie, I think, opened up a lot of doors for other people who came after to explore the strange and the dreamlike in their work, you know.
But one could argue to a certain extent that it is real too. It is just another level of reality, isn't it? It's an expressionist surreal level of reality that goes along with the camera that takes us to the back of the stage instead of staying in front of it, as if we are exploring the psyche of the character, but also this idea of pure art, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's real, right? You mean when it goes into the past the proscenium and into the story. I mean, I'm not saying that's not another level of reality, because I I think it is, absolutely. But for the audience, I guess, you know, for the audience of the film, I think it was certainly a new phenomenon to see that being represented. And then it's also making me think of, yeah, the psychology, things like, you know, things like Hitchcock's, you know, Spellbound. Is Spellbound the one with the dolly?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the ballet sequence is representing, you know, several things at once. Like, as you said, it's representing the, you know, the internal struggle of Vicky, you know, the torn between these two, you know, forces, love and dedication to art, while telling the story of the fairy tale, which is its own, you know, reality. So yeah, lots of levels of reality there.
And you had mentioned the filmography of Powell and Pressburger and how much a fan you are of their entire oeuvre. And I was thinking a lot about how The Red Shoes was preceded by Black Narcissus, which is another favorite of mine. I'm thinking about how a lot of times people compare ballerinas and the level of dedication required and the kind of cloistered life that a ballerina lives due to what her art form requires. It's often compared to nuns. And I've actually heard of unsuccessful ballerinas who turn to the church to become a nun. So I'm thinking about this kind of total dedication, total immersion in something that just kind of becomes your life and that really is your life. And I'm wondering how you relate to that as a writer.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think I was determined not to become an artist of any kind for most of the time I was growing up, because I was really scared of it. It's pretty terrifying in a lot of ways. It's funny. Maybe the red shoes scared me for a long time, but I was very, I think that I, when I decided, when I finally decided that I was going to try to write, I was 30. So I was like very late, because I didn't think I could do anything. And I was kind of in a place where I was at crossroads. Like, I mean, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And my mom, both my parents had always, and I was like, well, maybe I should try writing. So, I did become really obsessively insane with it for a long time. Like I started writing and I was like, this is phenomenal. I'm going to dedicate my life to this. And I pretty much just put everything else, like everything else, just by, no, I didn't, I worked, 10 hours a day and didn't eat and was just really, I mean, I got very un I've been very unhealthy with writing. So I think that making art is definitely quite easy to fall into the idea that this is really all that matters and that you can use this as a substitute for living your life. So that definitely is, I produced, like, so I started writing late, and then I got in, I someone that I was catering and working at a catering job with was like, there are advanced degrees in creative writing. I was like, what? What is this? And so then I looked into it, and I ended up going and getting an MFA, and then I further went on and got a PhD in English literature and creative writing. So for a large chunk of time, oh, that's all I did. And before I went too, so this is like, a period of like 15 years, I think that the only way that I would have been able to make the work that I've made was by doing that, because I think, I know lots of other people who write, who have, most of them end up getting married, having children, having families, having to then, and there's a way in which I think having, I do not have children, I have two stepchildren. And my husband and I got married when I think I was 42 when we got married. And there's a way in which I think it is always going to change what you make. It's going to change what you make, the way that having children and having to worry about them and having to think about the world that's coming for them and things like that. I think it, and so I, but I think for someone like me, the kind of work that I've done, I couldn't have done it unless I had completely devoted myself to it. But I don't really know if doing it was in the end worth it. I mean, I don't really know if doing it, if producing what I have produced was in the end important enough to sort of balance out the things that I've missed out on. Yeah, anyway.
You definitely don't have Lermontov's ego.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's
But
funny, the I was watching, I think it was Thelma Schoonmaker. There was like an interview with her. There were some extras on this. I have the Criterion DVD of the Red Shoes from like years ago that I bought years ago. And she was talking about, some the woman who was interviewing her asked her why she thought there weren't more female directors, and she was like, well, she said, I just think, she said, if I had something that I was desperate to say, I would direct a film. But I like doing what I do. I like editing the film and leaving it to, and thinking about figures like Scorsese and Lermontov. I'm thinking about the people who generally take that position, like the impresario, the person who's completely in charge and whose vision it is that we're all realizing. It's very difficult, I would say, for most women to get into a space where you could even imagine that you like deserve that or could handle that. I mean, for lots of women, for many women, I would say, because it's it is, there's a kind of like, I don't know, even though like my generation, we were told that, oh, we're post, Mary Tyler Moore was on television and she was single, so like we're fine with gender, there's no more gender problems, this is what we were told, we were like, oh, okay. But in fact, it's a totally it's a, it would be a completely different move for a woman to take that kind of role. And to this day, women are slammed, and you know, it's just, you know, in a public way, it's almost impossible for a woman to take that kind of role, you know.
I'd like to come back to the questions linked to feminism in just a second, but I was wondering, following what you described as your need to write so intensely, if your computer is red.
If my computer's red. No, but it should be. It probably should be. And I don't know if I own any red shoes right now. But I've had lots of red shoes in my life. Yes.
More seriously, the question of feminism, I think, is very interesting in relationship with this film in particular and with the work of Michael Powell, globally speaking, because I can think of, right at the top of my head, I can think of I Know What I'm Doing, Black
I know what I'm
Narcissus,
going.
Where I'm Going, sorry, this film, which all have very strong central female characters, which was by far not the majority at the time when those films were shot. So how do you feel about his relationship to women and to the chances he was giving them?
Yeah, and I just watched Gone to Earth, which I is like one of like two maybe three that I haven't seen, but I just recently watched that. It is, and I loved it. I thought it was really great. I thought Jennifer Jones did a great job. And that's another movie with a very strong and very unusual, you know, outside society, someone who lives outside, sort of pretty much outside human, like normal sort of circles, who's the central character. I do, yes, I think I f now I think Michael Powell, I think that he was smart. I think that this was a smart move on his part. I think that he saw an opportunity for, you know, because probably even at this time, yeah, I would imagine that even at this time, you know, women make up a huge part of the audience for film today. Readers, I mean, they're women. Women are who read books. So, you know, and from the beginning, they made up a large part of film audiences, I know, and probably I would imagine, well, I don't know, I haven't really looked up the statistics or anything, but so I think Powell saw an opening for, you know, bringing forth interest, like enigmatic, strong, you know, female characters that people had not seen before. And I think he probably felt, right, that, like, not unlike Lermontov, that he was, you know, that he felt, I think, probably pretty good about, you know, like that. Like, he was like, this is great of me. Aren't I a kind patriarchal figure? And in ways, yes, you know, in ways he did get, you know, and I also watched Black Narcissus again recently, and oh wow. I mean, Kathleen, is it Kathleen Byron, but is that her name? The Sister Ruth, that performance, and also Deborah Carr. I mean, and I think that was the film that like launched Deborah Carr's career. I think could have made her a star, I think, right? And he married, was he married to her? He married Deborah Carr.
Oh, I'm not sure about that, but you may be right. Yeah.
Think he was married to her. And I think the first film she did for him was Colonel Blimp. And I think that's right. And anyway, but yes, he was, I think he was smart. He was canny. He saw an opening in, you know, in the world of film, and he really exploited it like wildly. You know, the original, and I'm sure you guys probably know this too, but Pressburger's, the original treatment that he did was for Alexander Korda, and it was based on the relationship between Nijinsky and Dogliev. Diaghilev. I don't know exactly how you say things, because I've never talked to anyone about things. I always just think what I think about them, but I don't really get
I
to
know. Well,
talk
that's what's so wonderful about this.
but you know, so his original script was based on like the tension there, and how he kicked Nijinsky out when he got married, and everything. So I think, you know, turning it, you know, to a woman, make, you know, having the, you know, and you know, I say, I think at that time, you know, late 40s, like coming, you know, we were coming out of the wartime and going into, you know, the films had been saying like, you know, give your life for your country, and then we come to this, you know, the Red Shoes being this, you know, no, give your life to art, kind of that started a whole you know, I think that there's so many, not just films, but other, you know, texts that follow that idea from there. When people are free to think about things other than rationing and, you know, the war again, you know, I mean, it was still happening in England to a great extent, I'm sure, even when the film came out. But yeah, and so I think that Powell himself, you know, and then it's interesting, a movie like Peeping Tom, you know, but anyway, but yeah, so I think he was canny. He was smart. He knew what he was doing. And I do find his portrayals of women, and it's funny, I feel the same way about Bergman, which is like, because he was such not a great guy to the women in his life. I mean, you can't, you know, it's like, yet for me, the women that Bergman put on film are some of, I'm like, I am astonished by how much what he portrays resonates with me as a woman. And I don't know if it's because it's a generational thing, because I'm a product of the 20th century. You know, I just am, which is good. I like the 20th century. But I mean, there's a way in which everything that, you know, that I was told or read or saw was like imbued with the notions of the 20th century, like men are ultimately in charge or whatnot, you know, kind of this. So I find that there are these male filmmakers like Bergman, like Michael Powell, who, I mean, David Lean, I mean, there's so many who create female characters that I am like, wow, this is, how do you know so much about women, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway.
I'm so glad that you said that, because I've been hearing a lot of criticism of the film and women who keep labeling the film problematic without necessarily really expounding on why that is. But I do think that, for one thing, they talk a lot about the body horror of ballet and the fact that this film may have been really instrumental in launching a kind of ballet gothic aesthetic throughout the 20th century. And I think that's true. But at the same time, I think it would be a little reductive to say that it's only horrific, because for me, I really see Moira Shearer's character as someone who enjoys transcendent moments of art on stage. And a lot of people cite that, look, there's a close-up of her when she's dancing Swan Lake and Lermontov is in the audience, and there's a close-up and her face is really glaring as the Swan Queen. And this is mimicked in Black Swan. But I think that actually, just previously, the way that her head is held high, she executes a difficult series of turns across stage. To me, it looks like she's been transported by her art. She's really in the zone, and she's enjoying one of those moments of the kind of mastery over your art form that people dream about. And so I don't see it as just something horrific. And I think that that goes along with the gender question as well, to say that one could actually have some agency through their art form. And I do think that she has strong moments where she tells people, but I want this, or I'm going to dance. She's making these decisions. I mean, her mother sort of arranges the initial meeting, doesn't she, with Lermontov? But after that, it's really Vicky Page who's calling the shots and who's asserting herself. So I'm really glad that you saw that as well in the film.
Well, I mean, and I absolutely, I mean, I am of a mind, I mean, I see things in context. I can't help it. I think we're losing the concept of context. It's sort of like, we're losing it, right? I mean, young people can't understand what I mean, what, you know, students can't understand what I mean when I try to talk about context. And part of that is that we're losing a sense, we're just losing a sense of history. You know, we as a species are losing interest in things that were thought of as like bedrock important, like history, knowing what people have done before. Mm-hmm. You know, these things, young people don't think they're important. They think that, or a lot of young people, I'm sorry to be, I don't mean to be like, but a lot of young people think that the only context they know is online. That, you know, I mean, very young people, it's a world, you know, there's a shift happening right now where, you know, I only live in the physical world. It's the only place I'm capable of living. But like my stepchildren and their children, they will be mainly living in virtual worlds. I have, you know, I am almost positive, you know, I'm 99% sure. So, I mean, I absolutely, I mean, if Vicky Page wasn't a strong, independent woman, you know, in this movie, if that character doesn't represent, she's doing what she wants to do and she makes the choices she wants to make. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in the end, you know, the shoes taking her off, right? There's a way in which that final scene, but no, I mean, I would be, I have to disagree, but it's with people who think that you know the movie is harmful. But then again, you know, things that are considered, most of the things that I love, or a lot of the things I love, are considered harmful now. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It depends on, like, is art, it depends on what you're looking for, like why it is that you're watching art. If what you're watching The Red Shoes for is for it to tell you you're okay and everything's going to be okay, I don't know. You might not want to, because that's just not the case in any reality. You know, we're, you know, I mean, I think we, I mean, I would like for us to be more comfortable with the notion that we aren't okay and that that's okay, right? That
yes, and I think we tend to undervalue the ability of people to read things according to their own, I mean, through their own filters. I mean, we don't take, not everyone takes the same story the same way. We are able to analyze it and to decrypt it, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I would say that for me, Vicky, I mean, you know, I am like, you know, dance is a different, we're talking, dance is something that, and I can see, you know, because dance is something that is so, that it demands so much physically of your body, and that you, and this is like the difference. I think about this a lot, because a lot of, I'm really interested in actors and backstage life, like in general, and this movie may have been like sort of the genesis again of that too. But when I grew up, I did theater, and I was never like, I never had a starring role or any kind of speaking role. I was mostly a dancer because I could dance, you know, so I was like one of the background people who was dancing and doing things, townspeople. But I have this real obsession with what the lives of people who spend their entire lives pretending to be other people are like what that does to you as a, you know, as a person. Like, I'm this one person, and I'm like all these characters that I have played. How much of them is like, are there bits of them in there? Who am I now? What am I? So the people who actually perform with their bodies and give in that way on stage, for me, it feels like a totally different, like it's a different kind of making art than me sitting alone with my computer, you know. You know, it's such a, like, you're really committing to, you know, and it's, in a way, it's the perfect metaphor, like that this kind of art making is the perfect art making for The Red Shoes, because you are, they're forced to just, it's every bit of you. You're going to live or die by this. Your entire body is involved, you know, and it's, I mean, you know, dancers are incredibly strong. Like, you know how strong these people have to be just to do what they're doing. Like, I don't think that because, you know, and that's not to say that like women wanting to be dancers hasn't led to things that weren't healthy, like eating disorders and like people being hurt and like women having ridiculous images of what they should look like and things like that. Absolutely. But that doesn't discount for me, you know, the sheer beauty of the art form itself and what it shows us, what the human body can do. And if the people who are doing it want to be doing it, how can we say that it's, you know, I don't know, that they shouldn't be, or that it's in some way harmful to them? Maybe it is harmful to them on one level, but on another level, it's fulfilling a need they have, right? So anyway.
Absolutely. And I feel like a lot of people are very dismissive of ballet for the reasons that you cited. But, you know, it's an art form that's over 300 years old. So it's known different periods and different trends. And you can't reduce it to just, you know, a few problems that unfortunately we have in probably every area of life. But I just love the way that the ballets in The Red Shoes are used. I just wanted to mention first Swan Lake, of course, which is this trifecta of a woman who is caught between an older man who's imprisoned her in swan form and her love interest. So obviously that's the Julian Lermontov and Vicky Page triangle. And then we also see extracts from Giselle, which is a woman who's died of a broken heart, tragically. So we've got all of those different frames that you mentioned, those layers upon layers of stories nestled in the film. And I think it's interesting that, coming back to the feminism topic, that those are two ballets where I think that the lead roles for women have a lot of agency. Of course, it's not perfect and it often happens in death, but nonetheless, those are very strong women who have made certain choices, who have really asserted themselves and also lived with the consequences of those choices.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I remember I had the, I think I ordered, I found a copy or so, this big book of like the Royal Ballet. It's like a, it's like an illustrated, it's like a big book, illustrated, beautiful. And all the ballets in the Red Shoes were also in this book that I had, Coppelia and, you know, but yeah, even and you know, I guess the fact that a lot of times it was in death, right? So it, what you said is interesting, because they are allowed agency even if sometimes it's not, you know, it's in death. You know, I think that, you know, at the time, you know, when these ballets were conceived of, and you know, potentially that was one of the ways, like, that you could portray that, you know, and is not portraying it, because that's not the best way to portray it, a better idea than, you know, than portraying it in this way. I mean, I agree with you that I think those roles have incredible agency. I mean, in the ballet, the women are in the dancing, you know, in the structure of ballet itself, women are the, you know, the female dancers are the feature. Not that there weren't, you know, some male dancers who became big stars and were, you know, everybody, let's watch them jump. But really, most of the time in ballet, the men were there to support and lift the women. You know, the men are there to lift up the women in you know, traditionally. So there's a way in which, even though these women are having to, say, control their bodies in ways so that they can do the actual dancing, they are the focus of the dancing. So it's a very, like, you know, I mean, it's a thorny, complicated, right, relationship that I have with dance. I think that anybody, right, has with dance. But you know, ultimately, you know, and I don't know how much of it is that my, you know, my father and his parents were such fans of the ballet. But I will never not think that it's beautiful to see these bodies, you know, these bodies doing what you think bodies couldn't necessarily do. To witness it is just to, you know, it's joyous for me. And I think it's, hopefully the people who are doing it are getting joy out of it too. So.
Let's hope.
But I think these ideas are very interesting. I'm currently writing a book about Hitchcock and Lynch and the way the two are connected. And a lot of people say that Hitchcock and Lynch too are problematic in their depiction of women. But I think it is very complex too. I mean, it is not always straightforward. And there is a lot that can be said to defend them, and as much that can be said against them on those questions. And I think that somehow relates with what you've been discussing about ballet. I mean, it's a complex world we live in, and it's all too easy to come up to a Manichaean understanding of reality.
And I mean, with Hitchcock, I mean, you know, I'm also a huge Hitchcock fan. My father also showed me all of Hitchcock's films. And before, my dad had, he showed me films on film at first, before like VCRs existed, and before you could get videotapes of things. He was a, and so Hitchcock, like, I know Hitchcock, I know his movies so well. And I, you know, and again, it's not that I don't see, you know, to look at things out of context in the through the lens of today, and say this is problematic, is just something I'm never going to be able, I'm always going to push back against. I just can't help but push back against the idea that anybody, you know, that just because something doesn't fit into what we think today is the way that, you know, I can't imagine turning a blind eye. I mean, this is the, we have the choice of either ignoring what has come before and suffering the consequences, right? I mean, it seems like this applies to life, history, film, philosophy, science. I mean, everything. We have the choice of ignoring what's come before and suffering the potential consequences, or engaging with what's come before, you know, and keeping in mind that it, you know, that problematic, what is problematic to us today, like, I can hold space for that in my mind. Like, okay, that's problematic for today. I'm going to put that over here, but I'm still going to engage with this material, because I think it's far more important for us to engage with what has happened but previously than to ignore it. But I guess a lot of people, like, probably disagree with that sentiment today.
Oh, I give you a hear, hear.
It's tough. It's like a mine. It's in ways, it's like a minefield to talk about things like making art today, you know,
Is. It
in
really
ways.
I just want to come back briefly to this notion of achievement in death that you've mentioned concerning women. And I'm thinking here of the end of the Red Shoes when she jumps under the train. How do you read the symbolism of the train? Because it comes back several times throughout the film, doesn't it?
Yes. So the train, so, and this is another, I did actually want to talk about this. I also love, for whatever reason, I love train, I've always been drawn to train travel, like movies set on trains, love it. And just, you know, rewatching The Red Shoes the last couple times I watched it. And I mean, I knew this, you know, but you've got so much foreshadowing, right? You've got so much train foreshadowing, not, you know, them coming in, you know, when Julian and Vicky are standing, looking out, you know, and the train goes by and it's right where she later. And then, but then also the contained atmosphere or the contained environment setting of the train car where she's trapped twice with Lermontov inside, or twice. The first time when he, when she comes and asks, you know, and says to please don't fire Julian. And he says, and she says, well, I'm going with him then. And then the last time when he comes, when Lermontov comes to her and comes into her train. And so, you know, there's a way in which I think I think that, you know, trains are a way in which you're both trapped and moving, which is for me, I think that's one of the reasons that I'm so fascinated by them because you are trapped. I mean, the same thing applies to a plane and a car. I also been talking about this with my graduate students this past semester. We read stories in which people are driving, several stories in which people are there throughout the story are moving. And there's a certain kind of movement and a certain kind of character development that you can get to when people are trapped in a space together, and yet they're moving through the atmosphere, like through the setting environment, right? But they're trapped in a smaller space. So I think, you know, in terms of like the times when Vicky and Lermontov are in the car together, I think there's a definite like, you know, reading of she's trapped, you know, the sort of trapped in the space, but choosing the train as the choosing, right? The train as the element of her death, I think is, you know, it, I think it's it is escape. Like you know, the train can represent itself. It is escape. It's a way to get away. And it's also kind of a counterpoint. You could see it as a counterpoint to the drifting carriage scene, right? I think that you know, getting coming back to the drifting carriage scene, that is the moment of true, that's the moment of truth in the movie. True, you know, there's love, there's truth. This is a real feeling between these two young people, and that's this very brief, and it's slow, and it's they're drifting, and the music is nice. And then the counterpoint of that would be the, you know, the train screaming in as it does to the station, you know, and Vicky, you know, and her, you know, choosing, right, whether, and you know, that might be, I was trying to decide today, like, what is my favorite part of this movie? And I kept going, this part. Oh no, this part. But the that scene, the final scene when she begins, when she steps forward and steps forward with her dresser, and then there's that shot of her face where, and she's, and it's like, and then the shoes start to move her backwards, her feet go backwards, backwards. You see the red shoes moving backwards. And then from that moment, if you want to interpret it as from that moment, the shoes have the control. You know, if you want to see it that way, and they take her, of course, down the spiral stairs, down the spiral stairs, that shot of the spiral stairs. You know, and then the question of, you know, how much of, what, how much is the, is she doing this? Are the shoes really doing this, or is this Vicky's choice? But I think, in those ways that, you know, the train as this instrument of her, undoing, you know, it's really woven throughout the film. And is seeing it as a counterpoint to the carriage, I think is an interesting, potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we could talk about the color red. What is your relationship to the color red? It's so symbolic and it means so many different things in different cultures. What does it mean to you?
Well, let's see. I do like red shoes. I do like red hair, you know, and again, I'm like, does my obsession with red hair come from, you know, so many viewings of this movie when I was little? But the daring, I mean, you know, her, first of all, also watching the ballet today, women never have their hair down. You cannot dance, you know, it's like dancing with your hair down. And the way they have her hair, it's pulled back in the top, you know, that she's got the top part pulled back. But the fact that the length is down, you know, I think so much of her, of the look of it is about her hair. You know, I mean, Moira Shearer, that hair, I always have loved red hair. I dyed my hair red for many years. Like I've had various, you know, colors of red hair. You know, one of the first pairs of shoes I picked out for myself when I was a tiny child was like a pair of red tennis shoes with a yellow lightning stripe on the side. and my mom was like, really? Those are the shoes you want? You know, because those are pretty vivid. Like, you know, I'm like, nope, these are the shoes I want. So I am a fan of the color red, but of course, you know, it has, you know, the implications of blood, the implications of, you know, both harm or sort of gore, sort of, you know, and then also love, you know, this, it's also the heart, you know, love. But I mean, another thing about the red shoes that is just, I take the color, I am such a sucker. And I'm like, is it the time I grew up in? But it's like the hyper reality of the color is just so intoxicating for me. I mean, I am just seduced by Technicolor film automatically. And I think in particular, you know, in the red shoes, and there's red, you know, throughout, like little red touches, you know, throughout this movie. But I think that something that occurred to me when I was watching the red shoes this time is the Technicolor. And the setting of the artistic troupe, who are a family who are working hard on a project together, and the way that they get emotional and they fight and they throw things and they it's just such a, like, the hyper reality of kind of backstage life, the hyper reality of artists, you know, moving through the world, and then the hyper reality of Technicolor. I think all that is like building on top of, you know, I think all those elements give this movie, you know, elevate it in this way for me. In this sort of, there was this like, and I there's a, some people have referred to some kind of writing like David Foster Wallace as hyper reality, but that kind of, you know, I'm like, does anyone talk about hyper real in the writing world anymore? But it just occurred to me when I was watching the red shoes this time that vivid, intense hyper reality of the color, I think, ratchets up everything else, like sort of in the movie, you know, the tensions that are there and the, you know, and plays off of those wonderful, the backstage relationships and the very fiery people who are making, you know, making these productions.
That's such a good point, because I was thinking a lot about her red hair and wondering about that and thinking about the fact that, especially at that time in history, red hair was a lot less common than it is today, because it is a popular choice for dyeing your hair. Yeah. But we know redheads, real redheads are quite rare.
Yes.
The natural world. And thinking a lot about the fact that Maura Shearer had Scottish heritage and that she had this very Celtic look with the kind of very pale white skin and the brilliant red hair. And I was thinking about the fact that at that time, I think that red hair was actually more often associated with the kind of femme fatale, kind of pinup girl look. Right. If it didn't have that sort of Celtic association. And then that led me to wonder, would an English team like Powell and Pressburger possibly be using this very Celtic look as a way to sort of tame the Irish pagan? If we go back to the original folklore and think about the red shoes as this kind of vanity, cautionary tale in terms of not being too brilliant with your color, not showing off. I was just wondering if the hair is an extension of that, or if I'm just reading too much into that.
No, it could be too. And, you know, he loved, I mean, Deborah Carr and Kathleen Byron in Black Narcissus, there's something about, you know, the red, I think that the red hair, he seemed to sort of gravitate to women with red hair. And I do think that one of the main reasons, I mean, that they wanted Moira Shearer, you know, it, that they really were, they loved her hair. They loved that, you know, because as you say, very much more rare. And it's such a vivid, it's such a incredibly vivid red. And they, you know, as I was saying, they like make use of it by leaving her hair down in a ballet performance, which would, you know, is unheard of, I think, you know. But yeah, that is potentially, you know, seeing that as like taming the unruly, you know, as a sort of an unconscious part of that, I think could be.
Maybe. And we obviously, as you said, they really loved it because Moira Shearer comes back with pretty much the same hair.
Yes.
Tales of Hoffman in Peeping Tom, etc. So
yeah.
And I suppose you could argue that even when the red shoes are not on screen, they are there thanks to her hair. I mean,
they are absolutely
present thanks to that. Mm.
So is above, so below.
Yeah, that's true. And the red shoes. I also love the parts in the ballet where Leonid Messine is carrying the, you know, all the parts where the shoes are alone, you know, kind of on their own, and he's carrying them as the shoemaker. And of course the moment when she jumps into them, you know, the Robert Heltman, the dance, the paper dance. I was like, I was trying to decide which of her costumes is my favorite, you know, in the ballet, but I really can't choose. Like there's a part of me that I love the way she looks at the end when she's, you know, when she's like, everything's tattered and dark, you know, black and the tights are torn, you know, there's something about the way she looks at the very end of the ballet that I just love, you know, but her costumes, I mean, throughout are just, I just, you know, I love it. I love it. But yes, the period ballet costumes of the women who are just like the townspeople in the ballet, just ever since I was a kid, I've adored those.
As you said, the colors are so great. And I love this period in ballet on film, because as you mentioned, it's kind of the neoclassical period when they are modernizing, but they're also really taking advantage of the technicolor. And it feels like the costumes and the choreography have just found this perfect synchronicity that, I don't know, for me as a kid growing up, it kind of screamed modernity, but within this very classical tradition that was just super appealing to me.
Yeah, I think that's too how, you know, my dad would have seen, like my parents would have seen it too, you know, or people of their generation too. They were like, my dad was like, this is new, you know, this is new, this is revolutionary. You need to pay attention to this because, you know, if you, you know, and I'm like, but I don't, you know, I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. But he was he really wanted me to know like that, you know, both my parents were really into the idea of me being like making things, being a creator in some way. And, but he definitely, you know, you're right. It's got this new, this modern feeling, contained within this, classical framework. Absolutely. Yeah.
And, can you tell us about what you are currently creating?
Oh, I haven't gotten to work on this book in a long time, but I have a novel going and I'm about to hopefully get back into it. That is, it's basically, it is set in a Kirkbride insane asylum that's been converted into condominiums. And it's a novel. It's two time settings. One is two time settings. And for this is like I'm using Hollywood. Hollywood is coming into this novel. I used Francis Farmer, the story of Francis Farmer, as kind of a jumping off point. There's two time frames. One is when the asylum is an asylum and a famous Hollywood film star is committed to the asylum. And that interior story is told through the journal of the head nurse, who's running the asylum. And so then that's 1948. And then there's a current story, the current set about 2018 is I think where I'm going to set it. A film professor who is working on a book about the Hollywood star who disappeared. Well, the other part of this is that she and the head doctor disappeared from the insane asylum, and neither of them was ever seen or heard from again. So the current time protagonist is a female film professor who goes on sabbatical, and she stays in a condo that's in the converted Kirkbride Insane Asylum. And she's trying to like solve the mystery kind of what ultimately happened to this actress who disappeared from this asylum. So there's a lot of stuff about like women's mental health historically and how women have been, treated. And then also about classic Hollywood So the working title is Lady Maneater. So that's.
Ooh. Mm. And in the meantime, I believe we have Daughters of Chaos, which is coming out in July. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, this is my first novel. And it was inspired by the story of during the American Civil War, the city of Nashville attempted to exile their prostitutes. They rounded up the prostitutes, as many as they could, and put them on a riverboat and attempted to ship them off because they were blamed for the rampant spread of venereal disease amongst the soldiers. So it was the headquarters, Nashville was the headquarters of the Union Army's Western Theater. So, there were hundreds or tens of thousands of soldiers who flooded in. And so it was inspired by that, but it was also inspired by the Lysistrata. There's a lot of Greek mythology in there. So that's coming out in July.
I'm so excited to read it. I was so hoping to read it before the podcast, and then I realized when I looked online that it's not coming out until July.
Something
to look forward to.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy it.
I'm sure I will.
Thank you very much for having been our guest today. Oh, one last question, the one we always end up the podcast with. Is there a question we haven't asked that we should have asked?
Let's see. I don't think so. I can't really think of anything that I don't... Wait, let me see. Let me consult my notes here. Oh, I did wonder about... we talked about trades. I did wonder about, did Maura Shearer's, did this end her dancing career pretty much? No.
No, it didn't, though. It's true that I think it distracted from it a bit. And I'm always fascinated by the fact that ballet critics are always quite harsh with her. They're always mentioning the fact that she's not actually a great dancer, which might be compensated by her acting skills. Though I have to say, as a lover of Gothic ballet horror on film, I much prefer Maura Shearer, a professionally trained dancer, to the actors who clearly haven't had any ballet training when they appear in films. So, I think she continued on to dance in the UK and to tour internationally. And it's really interesting that she and so many of her dancer colleagues in the film had actually come from a background very similar to what's depicted in the film. I mean, the film is based on the Ballet Russe, which then became the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, the Diaghilev figure who had really kind of created that model for the impresario and the touring company and those really great interdisciplinary collaborations. So it's interesting that she really did come from such a background.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wondered if, like, I was like, did the movie, I wondered if like the movie had, like if it had done kind of to her, because I thought that I read that she was really unsure about doing it because she kind of thought it might end her career as a professional dancer. And then I thought if it had, the sort of irony on top of irony, like the art imitating life or life imitating art. But I'm glad that she continued dancing.
She was afraid that the movie would be like the train in the film.
Yeah.
Just as a fun side fact, the other ballerina, the ballerina who's already established when we first start watching the film, I always do a graveyard dance tour of my favorite defunct ballet dancers with my students. And that was Ludmila Cherina. And I walk past her grave on a regular basis. She's really close to Nijinsky in the cemetery.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
I always think of the Red Shoes when I walk through the cemetery.
Yeah, I bet. Irina, was it Boyanskaya? Was that her name in the
exactly.
film?
Boyanskaya.
Boyanskaya.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, that's cool. And so, and so you walk by where you live. It's close to where you are.
Yeah, it's in Paris. It's in Montmartre. Mm-hmm.
Wow, very nice. I've never been to France. I've never been anywhere.
Please come.
Oh, I would love to. I hope to do some traveling in the next couple of years because I've never been anywhere. And I'm like, well, I think, you know, I'm someone who really desperately wants to see like all kinds of things, but I just haven't ever had the resources to do so. So, or the time.
Opportunity to come, we'll be happy to show you around Paris.
Okay. That would be wonderful. Okay.
You can go visit Ludmila Cherina.
I would happily. Yes, I'd love to.
Okay. Well, okay. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. And we really hope that our listeners will read Mannequin and Wife, the wonderful collection of short stories that you wrote among your other books. And we are looking forward to Daughters of Chaos.
Okay. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. It was really wonderful to meet you guys and to talk about the Red Shoes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.